Welcome to episode 134 of the Get Cyber Resilient Show. Today is our Behind the Cyber News edition of the show. I'm Dan McDermott, your host, and I'm joined by our resident cybersecurity experts, Garrett O'Hara and Vin Yuan. Today, we will begin by looking into the story that Toyota Australia says that customer information has been publicly accessible for 6 years. Next, we'll dive into the supply chain attack impacting many high-profile British brands that is linked to a Russian cyber gang. And our final deep dive story is how the government is exploring regulations for artificial intelligence technologies. And we'll end with a wrap of the latest breaches and vulnerabilities to make the headlines. Gar, welcome back to the show. And as always, there's plenty of news headlines for us to delve behind. Let's begin with the news that customer data of Toyota Australia has been publicly accessible for 6 years. 6 years. Seriously, how does this happen?
Easily is the unfortunate answer. This is one in a very, very long string of public data being exposed or data being exposed publicly. Honestly, in many ways, same old story. Yeah, you got an Amazon S3 bucket and for whatever reason wasn't configured correctly. So stuff that, you know, in theory should have been private was public. But, you know, anyone who's not had their head in the sand for the last few years will kind of think back to many, many versions and stories of this stuff happening all across the world. Like S3 buckets I'm sure most people, or if not everybody, kind of knows what they are. So it's basically Amazon's storage service. So I think the S3 is simple storage service is actually what it stands for. Very commonly used, and it's a way to kind of get large scale storage in the cloud and, you know, drop anything that you kind of want in there. So all sounds great so far. And they're one of many organizations offering this kind of service, right? So it's not like unusual to do this. But the same as you would see with most cloud services, like the downside is, you know, through that kind of shared responsibility model, there's a little bit of, you know, Amazon does their stuff and provides the platform. Their job is to make sure that it's secure and does all the right thing. And then the folks who are using it, their responsibility is to make sure that it's configured correctly. So that's through ACL or, you know, just setting the bucket to public or not public as the case may be. And all too commonly, unfortunately, we see instances where some version of human error occurs and the config isn't done correctly and somebody discovers the bucket and then you hit the news because your stuff is out there and it's just another version of that. So it's, you know, it's not a new, I mean, it's a new story for Toyota in this case, but it's not a new story. It's a unfortunately oft-repeated version of this. And also, you know, the amount of time, and, you know, 6 years sounds like a long time, but it's amazing how often this stuff can live and be, you know, potentially exposed. And that's the important point here. It's the potential exposure that can go for a long time, but then you don't necessarily know has anyone accessed it or not, as the case may be. So in this case, yeah, as you say, it was 6 years. And interestingly, Toyota haven't had a good run. And you know, I think we've spoken about them previously. I think it's like three incidents in the last kind of couple of years. And this one actually kind of rides in the tails of an incident that happened in Japan, and where initially the thought was that Australian customers weren't affected. But, you know, here we go in this story as it's being reported. So, yeah, the stuff that's been exposed, it's the standard stuff, like its names, addresses, VINs, rego numbers could have been accessed. And that's kind of the important point here, is that stuff was exposed, but, like, was it accessed? Yeah, well, we don't know. I'm sure there's an investigation taking place, and, you know, we'll probably hear a follow-up from Toyota soon.
I'm sure there would be logs or something that would be able to say whether it has been accessed, and there should be knowing whether that is, you know, from known or unknown sources, I guess.
Well, look, it's one of those funny ones, right? The world of compliance and log storage gets pretty expensive pretty quickly. And depending on, you know, I have no way to comment. I have no idea how Toyota is set up or if they're using Seam in the back end or where those logs go. But like in theory, you know, if it was 6 years ago and an organization wasn't storing their logs for more than a year, then, like, would you know? You probably wouldn't. And look, you're right. I mean, most of this stuff would get logged in some way or another. But when you've got logs, and I'm guessing for an organization of any reasonable size, the amount of stuff that gets generated log-wise it gets very expensive very quickly to store that. And then the interrogation of that, like, again, that becomes difficult. They may have it on glacial storage somewhere. So, like, potentially those logs exist. And then, you know, the restoration of the logs to do the analysis and, like, all of that stuff. It's actually much more, it's more difficult than, you know, opening a big file and doing a, you know, a control F and nasty person access the file.
Exactly. I thought it would be much easier than all of that. But it's interesting that our good old friend Human Error just appears everywhere, doesn't it? It just has a way of turning up at all different places.
It's such an important point, Dan, because it's probably, the bias that exists because we work in an organization that protects people against human error, right? So we're very focused on the bit where people are doing the click on links or letting somebody tailgate them through the office or, you know, all of those kind of human error things that are very on the nose cyber. And the reality is, like, you've got developers who, through coding errors, introduce vulnerabilities, all the hardware problems that can be essentially kind of exploited to kind of exploit hardware vulnerabilities, or two to, like, physical penetration, where you look at stuff like the famous stuff where if you've got an IR detector on the other side of a door, you can blow smoke through the gap in the doors to make the IR sensor open the door and in you go, blah, blah, blah. Like, human error is literally the root cause of every single cyber breach and everything that ever goes wrong. And probably not going to steal thunder from one of our other stories, but until our robot overlords and the gods of AI are running things, I think we're probably going to continue to have many versions of human error problems. So, yeah.
Well, indeed. Well, our next story is a look into another very well-trodden attack type, that of a supply chain attack. This time, it has been linked to a Russian cyber gang and is impacting hundreds of businesses, and in particular, some very high-profile British organisations. Vin, what can you tell us about this attack?
We've got a few big companies based in the UK who are currently investigating potential theft of these details. I call them the three Bs, right? There's British Airways, there's BBC, and then there's Boots, which I only just found out they were, you know, a pharmaceutical shop. Funny that being called Boots. To your point, it's linked to a cyber attack that has been attributed to a Russian-linked criminal gang. Now, investigations are still happening, and British Airways are one of the first ones to confirm that, hey, you know, we were one of the companies affected by the hack. And it actually goes back to a software that one of their payroll/HR services uses, Zealous in this case. They're using a target software called MoveIt. So MoveIt essentially is a file transfer software. And like you mentioned, that it's that age-old tactic of supply chain upstream attacks. It's one where, you know, because of, and Guy, you kind of mentioned it before around like certain vulnerabilities that exist because maybe due to, I'm not saying in this case, but poor coding practice or not proper testing, like eventually these black hat attackers will actually find something and then exploit that. And then you've got this incredible situation where it's one piece of software then compromises multiple org, and that downstream just blows out of control, right? And in this case, it was a simple file transfer system that got done. As a result, we're getting more reports of, you know, organizations within the UK, outside the UK, looking into what type of data has been lost. And the type of data has ranged across different organizations as well.
And exactly. This one, again, it's one that we've spoken about many times before, and it is, I guess it's also, you know, happy payday, I guess, for the cyber criminals, right? Like, you know, find one vulnerability and impact many, is obviously one of the traits that they look at as, you know, looking to exploit, you know, such sort of, you know, supply chain or software sort of based attacks that, you know, that organizations use.
Absolutely. And like the cyber criminal gang behind this, now Clot Ransomware, and I think Microsoft, Atlas have also contributed to a group called Lace Tempest. They've done this before. Like, they know exactly what they're doing. And the scary thing this time is they're actually taking their time with this, this ransomware, to not just say, hey, we've got your data, pay us right away. They're actually going through it to see, you know, what's valuable, like, what do we ask? They're having a little bit more thought put behind it before they try anything else. But, you know, they've been known to carry out many different exploiting flaws in file transfer softwares over the years as well. So this isn't the first rodeo, know exactly what they're doing.
Yeah, they definitely do. I think, I mean, the timing of the attack as well, around holiday time, it's a sort of fairly common trait for them. But that's something you see all the time, right? It's the attack happens on the 23rd of December, or some of the more famous ones. They'll look at the kind of things that are happening in the real world and then time their attacks for people to be away on holidays or times where they know that the IT and security teams are going to be lean or non-existent because everyone's off, you know, eating turkey or, you know, doing whatever people do when they take time off work. But they're certainly probably paying less attention to their phones for, you know, P1 alerts. And then, you know, probably even if they see them, they've had a few beers and, you know, the ability to respond might go out the window a little bit. Meantime, to sober up is a metric we don't track nearly enough in cybersecurity world. But, you know, it's probably an important one, actually, as I think about it. Maybe that is get breathalyzed on the way into the SOC on the P1. But, you know, the timing of these events isn't random. Obviously, I'm kind of stating the obvious there. But it goes to Vin's point about how well organized most of these crews are now, where they're not just kind of randomly sending stuff out. They'll time tax so that it, you know, it's going to have the best effect, most meaningful effect.
Well, insightful as always, but a new stat of mean time to sober up is certainly one that I think we'll have to hashtag that and see what what we can make of it. Our final deep dive review for this episode is a look into how the federal government are exploring regulation options to control the use of AI. But before delving into the Australian response, first, I will quickly read a statement released on AI risk, written by the Centre for AI Safety, that has been signed by many AI scientists and other notable figures, including Bill Gates and Bruce Schneier. The statement aims to voice concerns about some of advanced AI's most severe risks. Okay, here it is. Mitigating the risk of extinction from AI should be a global priority, alongside other societal scale risks such as pandemics and nuclear war. Wow, Gar, now that is pretty heavy. So what can you tell us about this statement and Australia's proposed response to the risks posed by AI?
Yeah, it's a whopper. That statement, you know, when you hear the kind of background stuff on why it was kept short, it was deliberate. You know, it wasn't getting the weeds of the thing. It was more of a how to get broad consensus from a bunch of people in terms of the level of the risk. Pandemics and nuclear war, like equating AI with that, like sort of tells you where many people's heads are at. And if people have rich lives, they probably haven't. But if you read through the signatories, like there's some big names here. They're not, you know, they're not the preppers. They're not the tinfoil hat wearers. They're actually just regular, you know, folk who sort of operate in IT, academics, as you said. Like they're thinking, thoughtful people who've kind of looked through this stuff. And you know, like I'm sure you both kind of get it. I'm sure everyone does at this stage. Like I'm definitely on the side of, I think technology's biggest problem is that so often we ask the question, can we do it rather than should we? And, you know, the tech bro culture of, you know, break things, move fast, all that has got us in trouble. Like, that's the reality. You look at social media. There's so many things that are just bonkers if you're going to actually plan things out for the best for society. And AI is another one. Incredibly impressive stuff, right? It's, you know, it's beautiful. It's impressive. And we also have no idea about so many of the risks that it presents. And we're moving faster than the technology, as per usual, and policy and regulation kind of lets us. So, you know, all good, amazing technology. And then the downside is the huge societal impact that this stuff will have. I don't know if people, I mean, I'm saying people don't get it. People do get it. But I don't know if it's rippled out to like broad society what this actually means. It's absolutely huge. The ChatGPT stuff, I mean, I don't know about you guys. I don't ever remember like something hitting and being as jaw-dropping in terms of, you know, how many people were talking about it, what it was getting used for. Like just astonishing, like writing code, writing essays, checking for plagiarism. Like this is just, yeah, it's bonkers level stuff. But the sort of cat's out of the bag, the toothpaste's out of the horse. No, it's not. It's out of the tube. The other stuff's out of the horse. If that stuff came out of a toothpaste tube, you probably want to get your money back. But we're at a point, like as we so often are, that you know, the tech is amazing. We're probably enamored and endeared by like just how exciting it is and all of the funny tricks that ChatGPT can do. But what about the impact in jobs? There's a bunch of jobs that will go away and go away quicker than people realize. And it's not the ones that we traditionally thought, you know, the kind of, like, hate to say it, but like the support desk where they're answering phones and really just reading KB articles, like, cool, a robot's going to do that better, cheaper, more consistently than a human will, with less reaction to angry customers. But what about truck drivers? You know, you look at how close that stuff is starting to get, where there's a bunch of companies now that are operating long distance, truck driving. Lawyers, that's one that's been talked about quite a lot. And I know there's kind of division over like what the future is there. There's a sort of funny case that hit in, I think it was in the US, where a lawyer had basically put a, you know, submission into a judge and had used ChatGPT, but the thing had hallucinated and basically cited a bunch of cases and briefs and dockets that just didn't exist. So he got a spanking from the judge. But you can see like where the appetite is. Like, you're looking at somebody, and that was an experienced guy. You've been around decades. So you can see already the appetite to look at AI for shortcuts, to do things quicker, easier. And we just haven't even seen the start of what this is going to impact in terms of jobs and how we interact with each other and all of that good stuff. I'm in a bit of a rant here. I probably should shut up. But like, if you look at the AI risks on that website, the one that you took the quote from, Dan, it's actually worth a read. Like, it's thoughtful. It's not hand wavy. It is like, here's some stuff we need to think about and we probably haven't. I kind of made the joke on LinkedIn earlier. I learned the words enfeeblement from that list of risks. And that was one of the kind of more innocuous ones. But, you know, if you think of enfeeblement, it's basically WALL-E. You know, I'm guessing you guys have seen that that movie, and the bit where the humans are kind of like basically hovering around on these stretchers getting fed, you know, nutrient, but they're not human anymore. They just don't know how to do anything. They're just these blobs of, you know, biomass that are getting fed and watching probably reality TV to keep them distracted and entertained. But anyway, I think this is a good thing. That risks comment, that's important. And then, you know, the Australian context here, which is, I suppose, what the point of the question was, is also important. Like, we're in an in a country that I would say is astonishingly talented when it comes to compute, like doing amazing stuff with quantum, definitely doing some awesome stuff with AI. And our problem now as a country is, like, how do you balance AI and protection of Australians when you now need AI to compete with the rest of the world, in terms of kind of global marketplace? It's going to be a huge differentiator. So who's got the best AI technology is going to definitely be a signal and a pointer and a proxy for who's going to have the highest GDP, or, you know, who's going to make the most coin. All good, right? So how do we do this as Australia without the rest of the world kind of going, okay, we all get the risks and we're all going to like tamp it down, we'll all regulate, we'll all do the right thing? Is it like biochemicals? Like, is it like that stuff where, you know, the world agreed, hey, we probably shouldn't, you know, invent the thing that's going to, if it gets released from the test tube, it's going to kill us all, you know, within a week. Like, let's agree that that's probably not a good idea. I think that's the spirit of that that quote that you read earlier, is that. It's just like, let's calm down. Let's not, like, do the silly thing that ends up with a, you know, it's as an existential crisis. And then Australia is just part of that. We've been pretty forward looking, by the way. We were one of the first countries to do voluntary a code of ethics when it came to AI, which is awesome. Like, that's years ago we did that. But I think we're at a point where if this stuff isn't made mandatory, then the competitive pressures for the market is going to push people to do more and more, more aggressively, more quickly. And who knows where that ends for all of us. And personally, like, I don't want to be floating around on a hoverboard, you know, getting fed mush, watching reality TV. Like, I want to live my life. I want to be a functioning human. Rant over, soapbox put away for a moment.
Well, I mean, I think it's interesting, right? I mean, this is, like you say, it's a topic that is so much bigger than just like, ChatGPT can, you know, do this cool stuff, right? Like, to think of it in the scale of pandemics and nuclear war and putting it a light on it like that is very, very different to just sort of, you know, oh, well, it might be able to do, you know, write an essay, you know, for my school assignment quickly. It's very, very different. And, you know, enfeeblement, as you said, you know, is the definition is around humanity loses the ability to self-govern and becomes completely dependent on machines. It's quite a scary thought, right? And
I think I've mentioned this guy before, but Gerd Leonard, who's a futurist out of Switzerland, wrote a book in 2016 called Technology versus Humanity, all about this. I brought Gerd to Australia 10 years ago to talk about AI and the future of work for an event series I was running. And it was, you know, it was fascinating, but it was sort of felt so far away, you know, and it was sort of like, oh, you know, one day in 2025, this sort of thing might happen. And here we are. Definitely shout out to him that was did a good job as a futurist of actually predicting something that did happen rather than a lot of the futurists that just say stuff that never actually happens. But it is quite amazing that that day has dawned, right? We are here. It's upon us. And I think the thing is that I reflect back on as well is that it's been coming for some time. So it feels like it happened overnight, right? It's a bit like any overnight sensation. There was years of preparation in the background to that moment. But I think the release of ChatGPT and making that so accessible and wide scale was sort of the flashpoint that has sort of brought it to the forefront of everyone's mind and has made it very real and very, very now. So it's going to be interesting to see. I think regulations are extremely difficult in this realm, right? And like you say, the competitive pressures, and even if we regulate, will everyone play nicely around the world? You know, considering, you know, we've done 134 episodes of a podcast on what the bad people do around cyber, I'm not sure that they are all going to comply with our AI regulations either. So definitely a massive topic and one that is going to define, you know, work and society, I think, going forward.
And do we end up with, I mean, universal basic income? Is this the thing that finally kicks that in? Like, do I basically get to quit and just like sit around watching TV or the birds? Yeah, who knows? But to your point, Dan, like it's, stuff is huge. Like it is so, so big. And I think, you know, some of the kind of the things they're looking at is kind of risk profiling the AI application. So like low, medium and high. And then depending on what the application of the AI technology, you know, you've got to do more due diligence and I presume more testing, you know, put more rails on the thing. And some of the examples, you know, chess AI, it's relatively innocuous. You know, if it gets really good, the worst thing that's going to happen is it's just going to beat people at playing chess. But then you get into AI surgeons and that starts to get a little bit more funky, right? I mean, you're into like literally somebody's life based on an AI, you know, presumably a robot with a scalpel doing and tweezers or whatever, like doing some stuff to a human body. Like that's pretty big. Even the labeling, I think, is useful and important because at least it starts to give the public some sense of, like, you know, low, medium, high. Like, you can start to have a better conversation versus right now, it's to your point, Dan, like, we're just bucketing AI in this huge, big, monolithic blob of stuff when in reality, like, it's lots of different things. There's lots of different types. You know, obviously, generative AI has got a huge amount of coverage because of ChatGPT, but that's only one type of many, many types of AI. And part of the scary thing, like personally, but I think for a lot of people, is the bit where when you ask the people who've developed these things, like, how's the thing doing what it's doing? And they go, you know, I get a bit of a shrug of the shoulders and they kind of say, well, we don't know. And that's the thing. I read years ago, I think it was Facebook or one of those social media platforms where they didn't really understand how the thing was recognizing faces. Like they'd written the code. Obviously, humans had created this stuff, but it had gone off and, you know, it learned and done a bunch of stuff. And then they're like, yeah, I don't know, just it does it. It works, but we don't really know how it does. Like that's, you know, that's where it starts to get really weird and frightening.
Definitely, like it can definitely replace people. I'm actually not here. This is just a deep fake. I'm actually sitting on the couch watching the NBA finals at the moment. So, unfortunately still working away, so we might get to that one day. Finally, let's wrap up with a quick review of the latest breaches of vulnerabilities to make the headlines. The first news item is a public service announcement from security company Barracuda. Finn, what do people need to be aware of here?
Well, this is for the I guess organizations currently leveraging Barracuda's email security gateway. I think it's clear to delineate that it's only for the on-prem appliance deployment of it because they do also have a cloud offering. But essentially, following a discovery exercise in May 2023 this year, there's been patches that have been sent out to kind of patch these ESG appliances worldwide. Now, the words from Barracuda is this isn't enough to address the vulnerability, but now they're recommending that any impacted appliances actually be immediately replaced, regardless of whatever patch level you're at or what you've done with it so far. You need to go ahead and change that. For those Barracuda customers, there should be like a little pop-up or something to let you know in your UI to contact support, but really appear safe for anyone out there using the appliance for ESG for Barracuda. Work with support, get a new appliance in place because the vulnerability is there. And we've actually had some more recent news in the ACT government have kind of come out saying that they're addressing something along the lines of that as well. So I think this might be a watch this space as we kind of figure out like the impact and flow on effect from, you know, having a vulnerability within a security appliance.
Indeed. Well, the next story is an immediate risk from our new friend AI. It's how ChatGPT can help software supply chain attackers. This sounds worrying. I mean, really, like these guys need any more help.
Yeah, poor attackers. Maybe they're the first ones out of a job, hey? It's the hallucination stuff again, but being able to use the hallucinations from ChatGPT to basically, so kind of rolling back, people are kind of using ChatGPT to make code, generate code. And the problem is that we've talked about it down on the show a bunch of times, like supply chain when it comes to using libraries. So, you know, often kind of free open source libraries to Log4j is an example, right? So, you know, a bunch of people do that when you're developing code. If somebody's already done it, you don't recreate the wheel. You basically just link to the library and then let that do the heavy lifting of whatever it is you want to do. So as ChatGPT is being used to write code, the thing can occasionally hallucinate things that don't actually exist. So URLs, code libraries, functions, things that just literally are imaginary. And the way you can then take advantage of that is like that code gets out in the wild. But if you then kind of back create the libraries or the URLs, you basically have the code pointing to things that are then essentially malicious. So it's a way to, you know, spread those malicious packages around. And you don't really need to do anything funky there because, you know, the AI has created the code. And again, it doesn't know, right? It's just having a hallucination. It's made a, you know, it's made a, it's not a human error. Actually, what is it? Do we have a whole new category of thing now where it's not human error, it's robot error?
Error. I don't know.
Man, I'm going to have to backtrack on what I said at the start where I said like every problem comes back to human error, but actually now it doesn't because of this stuff. But anyway, yeah. So you get these, fake libraries, hallucinated libraries, URLs, links, whatever they may be. And then what the attackers can do is basically just go back and kind of, you know, fill in those with the, malicious package, whatever they want to get out there.
Very scary stuff. And to think that a machine is having hallucinations, like that's a new one. I hadn't heard of that before.
Wasn't there a book, Do Robots Dream of Sheep or something? Did I make that up? Maybe I have. I think Isaac Asimov.
Might be one of your hallucinations. I'm not sure.
Yeah, probably is. Yeah.
Finally, Latitude Financial are quickly counting the costs from their recent cyber attack. Vin, the financial impact seems large and immediate.
It is so huge. And we covered this story, I think back in March was when it happened with Latitude Financial and the incident there. But they're forecasting a first half statutory loss of between $95 to $105 million. That's a lot of money. The hit itself is, you know, based off its inability to earn income for 5 weeks, they couldn't collect payments and, you know, accept new signups. Like, that's a heavy cost, right? And it's a cost that is not even capped because if we think about the $95 to $105 million, that doesn't include anything that might have to do with regulatory compliance, like fines, or class actions as well. So I feel like this is a start. I feel like as this develops more and more that this number is going to increase, but it's a gigantic number. It's bigger than most numbers that come out of these independent studies and analysts. Take, for example, Verizon's data breach investigation report. If you look at the average cost of a cyber breach, it's not $105 million. So it just kind of shows that depending on the spread, the attack, also the organization, like it's a lot of variation that can come with a cost for an organization.
Indeed. Well, thank you, Gar and Vin. Appreciate all your insights in another big news episode today. But I have to say, I've actually learned three new things. AI hallucinations, that's one. Getting the toothpaste out of the horse is an interesting one. And obviously, mean time to sober up for IT professionals. Fantastic insights. Gar, putting that aside, who do you have as our special guest for us next week?
So next week is Belinda Knoll from Sekov. So Belinda and Sekov actually work in the OT space, which is actually really, really fascinating. So it's a conversation obviously around the cybersecurity concerns and considerations of OT, how that's converging with IT. But also her organization are doing some very cool stuff around sort of the voice of the OT people, who tend to be probably a different profile than your standard cyber person. They tend to be folks who have worked in that sort of arena and area, very niche, very expert, and have been around decades. So they're doing an awesome job of kind of, bringing the people side of that together with things like meetups and some of the cool actually stories that Belinda tells around how OT security works and some of the things to think about that honestly I hadn't even thought about until we spoke. So yeah, really, really awesome conversation with Belinda.
Fantastic. Really looking forward to that. So until next week, if you'd like to continue exploring key topics in cybersecurity, please jump onto getcyberresilient.com and check out some of the latest articles, including TikTok, Time to Stop, and Deepfakes and Biohacks, How New AI is Helping Hackers Fool Cutting-Edge Security. Thanks for listening, and until next time, stay safe.